Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The University of Maryland has launched a new institute dedicated to developing the next generation of artificial intelligence people. The Artificial Intelligence Interdisciplinary Institute will support research focusing on responsible and ethical AI across industry and government. For details, Federal News Network's Eric White spoke to the institute's director, Professor Hal Daumet.
Sort of proximally, the institute got started because last summer the provost came to us and said, what would it look like to have an institute that crosses all of campus and, you know, sort of unifies AI everywhere in research and education? And so we had a working group last summer that put together a vision document of what that might look like and what it would take. And, you know, I have to say, somewhat surprisingly, maybe for a public university, you know, less than 6 months later, we actually have an announcement of a new thing. And, you know, I think this is both sort of a sign of the times. You know, this is, I think, a really important topic that lots of people are thinking about. But I also think it's also a signal that our president and provost are really good at moving fast when things are important.
Let me reiterate their question to you. What would it look like? And what is this institute going to include?
You know, the goal here really is to think about how do we take AI, which is something that's, you know, I think pretty clearly affecting almost everything these days, and think about it not just sort of from the perspective of like computer science or engineering, which is where it kind of historically has lived, and really think about it from the perspective of both the sort of different career paths that students might take, right? What does it look like to be a journalist in 5 years? What does it look like to be a professor in 5 years? But also like the expertise on campus. And I think one of the reasons this is really important is I think the big AI challenge that we face over the next 10 years is how do we figure out how to build AI systems that like reflect human values, that promote the well-being of humanity, that sort of like do good in the world? And, you know, these questions of like, what are human values? Like, what happens to society? I mean, these are questions that like humanists study and social scientists study. These are not traditionally questions that computer scientists study. And so like, if we want to answer these questions, I think it's really essential that, you know, kind of everyone is at the table as an equal player.
So is this institute going to focus more on the ethics of AI use and development rather than the actual creation of it? Or is it going to be a little bit of both?
I think the goal is that it's a little bit of both. You know, I think University of Maryland has had a strength in AI sort of research and development, technology development, whatever you want to call it, for decades. And, you know, so a lot of this is sort of like building on that strength, but also sort of shifting it a little bit so that we're thinking about not just developing technology for the sake of developing technology, which is, I think, how a lot of maybe engineering mindset people think, but really thinking specifically about like, okay, what is the impact of this technology on people? How do I change my practices and change the type of AI system that I develop so that, you know, it's most likely to have like a positive impact on people?
We're speaking with Hal Daumet. He is a computer scientist professor at the University of Maryland and the new director of UMD's AI Institute. We talk a lot about ethical AI. It is a term that has a different meaning, it seems like, to everyone. And yeah, as you just mentioned, you know, in the past, it did seem whenever a new technology came along, it was, let's just create it, let's put it out there and let the chips fall where they may, and we'll see what happens. Do you see as AI as being different because of the magnitude of what its impact could be?
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes AI different, and I guess when I say AI, I really mean sort of like data-driven either decision-making or generation of, say, documents or images or something like that, right? So the data-driven, I think, is the key here. And I think what we're seeing increasingly is that data is available in a huge wide variety of domains now, which means that the potential for applying sort of this single technology to a wide variety of domains has now become like a practicality, whereas previous approaches to AI that were maybe not data-driven didn't really have that potential to be broadly applied.
It just seems as if, you know, for the first time, the folks who actually are responsible for inventing it and getting it out there for consumer use seem to be the ones that are the most hesitant to say, okay, let's just, you know, take a pause here for a second, whereas usually that's not the case, at least from what I've seen as far as, you know, just covering technology. But I didn't know if that was maybe what you experience or how you feel about it.
Yeah, I think that what we see in sort of like technology development in general is really this, you know, like you said, we'll push it out, we'll see what happens. And, you know, I think there's a lot of value to this. And I think that, you know, lots of really useful technologies have been developed this way. I think what we're coming to realize is that, like, a key property, I think, of almost any AI system is that it's not going to be perfect. Like, all of these data-driven systems, right, they're sort of doing their best given the data that they've seen in the past. And I think unlike a lot of traditional computer science where, for instance, you can prove that the system I deploy will do X, Y, and Z, nowadays we're in this kind of world where we're like, well, I hope it does X, Y, and Z. And, you know, what we're seeing is that when it doesn't, sometimes the mistakes that it makes, which are often really hard to foresee, can have pretty consequential impacts on people's lives, right? Like, we've seen examples of Medicaid getting withheld that led to a big case in Arkansas. And, you know, we've seen cases of people getting into fist fights over translation errors and, you know, all sorts of things where this property of AI that, you know, it's not exactly unique to AI, but I think AI really brings it to the forefront that, you know, these systems are just not going to be perfect. And so how do we engineer something around that that lets people still use them productively while also taking into account the fact that, you know, yeah, they're going to make mistakes and we need to make sure that those mistakes don't cause, you know, sort of irreparable harm or even, you know, large magnitude harm to people.
Getting back to the Institute, so it sounds as if, you know, you're saying AI is going to be creeping into so many different things that you're not necessarily just looking for the people that are, you know, trying to get into the AI field when they graduate. This could be something for, say, a journalism student or a first year medical student may want to try and get their hands on just to see where exactly the technology lays. Did I make a wrong assumption there?
No, that's exactly right. So at the undergraduate level, I mean, we're planning on rolling out some degree programs on AI. But in some ways, I think that some of the really exciting stuff is on what I'm kind of calling like the path to AI, where the idea is that, you know, pretty much any freshman who shows up on campus, no matter what your major is, should have a breadth of AI related courses that they can take that will help prepare them for their future career, but also for their future time as a student. Right? Because, you know, AI is affecting the lives of students just like it's affecting the lives of normal people or non-students. And, you know, so I think that the real potential here is, you know, how do we build this sort of AI-minded future workforce, both among our current students and then also through like professional certificate programs. So people who are current day nurses or current day journalists or, you know, current day K-12 teachers or something, right, can come and, you know, sort of upskill around AI as it affects their profession.
Yeah, there's nothing normal about being a college student. I can attest to that for sure.
This is true.
So, what about the folks that are trying to get into the AI field in particular? Are the jobs that many of the AI, I'll call them apologists, have said that, you know, they'll counterbalance the jobs that are eliminated by AI, are there going to be actual careers there as far as maintaining and just kind of controlling AI rather than actually, you know, doing a job that the AI is actually doing itself?
I think that's a great question. And I'll take a step back, right? Like, when I say that, you know, AI is transforming industries, right, it is also transforming computer science, right? And we see a bunch of tools, you know, I think like GitHub Copilot is probably the one that's most recognized. There was just an announcement a couple of days ago about a new sort of software development oriented AI system, right? And so I think the face of programming itself is changing. And in the same way that we might ask, you know, is there a future career for journalists, just to pick on you? You know, we could also say, is there a future career for programmers? And, you know, I guess I'm an optimist. Like, I think that these jobs will shift and how people will spend their time will shift. But I don't think that the jobs themselves are going anywhere. One way that I think is useful to think about this is that what AI systems are good at automating is tasks. And one person's job is not just one task. Like the easiest example here is self-driving taxis. The taxi driver, they drive, but they also clean the car. They also talk to passengers. They collect fares, right? There's a lot more to this job than just the single task of driving the car. And so I think what we might see is shifting of tasks from some things to others. But I don't think in the short term we're going to be seeing, you know, sort of this large shift of, you know, such and such job doesn't exist anymore.
Hal Dahmey is a computer science professor at the University of Maryland, speaking with Federal News Network's Eric White. You can find this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies. And we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.